All right, so last of the letters. We've gone through, as I said, this summer, trying to look at each of these letters, these seven letters that Jesus handpicks the churches in each of these major cities, and he writes to them, he speaks to them. One of the only times we have that where he actually directly speaks to them, he says, here, I got some things I got to tell you people. You call yourself a church. You go to church every week. You're good Christians. Now, we got to fix something. And almost every letter is interesting because if almost every of the letters, the other six, follow a certain pattern. Jesus comes to them and says, here I am, I'm Jesus. You're doing this really well. This one, not so much. Let's clean it up. And if you do, there's infinite joy for you. But you got to get it right, he says. You got to get back to grace. You got to go back to the gospel. You got to get back to seeing him, putting him at the center, putting him as your first love, putting him in the place where you will go for comfort and security when trials and tests come on you. Now, the letter to Laodicea. It's the last one, and it's not the end of the series, actually. What we're going to be doing, just to give you a foretaste, is that over the next 3 weeks, we're going to look at the end of the book of Revelation. So for those of you who have been interested in the book of Revelation, we're going to look at the end of the book, and specifically what God is saying, what Jesus is saying, the church is going to look like in the end of time. What's the goal? Why are we here? Why do you come every Sunday or every other Sunday to church? What's it all adding up to? And there's a grand narrative, and it's a beautiful narrative. And he paints that story, and he gets to it at the end of Revelation. So we're going to spend the next few weeks looking at that. But this one today is the last of the letters to the churches. And Laodicea, and he says, really nothing good to say about them. Nothing positive. This is an urban church. The people are well off. They're probably educated. Good jobs. Good families, secure. We'll look at that in a little bit. They have everything they need in life. And Jesus says, that's the problem. You think you have everything, and you have no idea what you're lacking. I said this at the beginning, at the introduction, that this is the letter that most commentators point out that most urban churches, such as us, closely resemble. See, the church in Smyrna, he says, you're going to go through 10 days of intense, brutal persecution. And that's not really us these days. And he has some other messages for other churches that may apply to us at one time or another, but the church in Laodicea, more so than any of the other churches that he writes to, is indicative of the contemporary modern church. Educated, well off, good jobs, nice careers, comfort, security. And he says, that's the problem. What do I mean? Well, here, Jesus says this. He says at the end, he goes, you're going to have to come to me and buy eye salve. You're going to have to buy eye salve. Basically, this is like medication. And we'll get to it a little bit. But the church, the city of Laodicea was known for it had a medical center. It's known for three main things. One of them is that it was a medical center. And it produced this really, really cool thing called eye cream. And if you had eye problems, you would make the long trip to Laodicea and you would get this eye medicine. And it was really, really well known for it. And in essence, what Jesus is saying is you're sick. You guys as a church, you're Christians. Okay. But you're sick, and you'll need medicine, he says. And he says, come to me and you'll get it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to pretend that we're going to call him Dr. Jesus today. Is that okay? That's not sacrilegious. We'll call him Dr. Jesus because he's trying to heal them. But he says, first, in order for you to get healed by Dr. Jesus, you need to know the symptoms of the problem. Then you need to know the sickness behind the problem and ultimately the medicine for the cure, which is what he offers here, the gospel. But he does it very uniquely and very interestingly to this church in Laodicea. First, the symptoms. What's the symptom? What's the problem? Well, he gets to it in verse 15 and 16, and some of your translations may say something like, be earnest. Which is like a word, I don't ever really use that word anymore. The translation that we read tonight says, be zealous. And that's what the Greek word is. He's telling them, be zealous. And the Greek word zealous, it comes from a word, it's hard to explain this, it's an onomatopoeia, which is like buzz, or what are the ones, coo or whatever, I don't know. It's words that sound, they're written as if they sound that way. I'll put it that way. And for some reason, somewhere along the line, somebody thought the word zealous sounded like a pot boiling of water and boiling over. I have no idea why. Does it sound like a zeal? No. It sounds like bubble, 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 right? But they didn't have bubble then. They just said zealous. And so the word zealous means boiling over. It means utterly boiling, can't stay in the pot. Bubble, 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 toil and trouble. Goes over. It's bubbling. It's hot. Now listen, here's the symptom. Here's the problem, he says. Laodicea, you're lukewarm. He says, I wish you were either hot or cold. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a little bit because it often gets mistranslated. But he says, you're lukewarm, and I need to spit you out. It makes me nauseous. You're not boiling anymore. You're not zealous. And interestingly, if you go through the New Testament, this word zealous is often translated, either it can be translated as earnest, but in other parts of the Bible, it's translated mainly in the New Testament as jealous. Jesus says, you're not jealous for me anymore. You're not jealous for me. Think about this. What happens when you're jealous of something or jealous for something? What does it mean? It can have a negative connotation or it can have a positive connotation. Most of the time we think of it as negative, green with envy, jealous. But that's it. It can be positive or negative, and it depends entirely upon which object your jealousy is pointed towards. Let me explain. If you're jealous for anything but God, then you will be jealous of other people who have that thing that you don't have. That's the negative jealousy. So if you're jealous, if you put money, career, ambition, success, family, whatever it is, if you put something in the central place that God should be in and you're jealous for that, then you will burn with jealousy for all those people who have that thing that you don't have. You see? That's green with envy. But Jesus says, I need you to be jealous for me. To be jealous of something is to set your heart so intently on that thing. It's so focused on one thing and one thing alone that if you set your heart on God, you'll be jealous for him. You'll want him. But if you set your heart on anything else, you'll be jealous of all the people around you who have that thing that you don't have. If you're jealous about family and comfort, you'll look around, if you're not married or if you don't have children, and you'll look around at those who do, and you'll be jealous of them. Why? Because you put family and comfort right into the center place on the throne where God should be. What is it? That's the supreme passion of your heart. What he does is he looks at this church in Laodicea and he says, you're lukewarm, you make me nauseous, I want to spit you out. Because you're not jealous for me anymore. You've gotten everything you've ever wanted in life. Nice clothes, he says. Comfort, he says. Security, and look at what has happened to you. You become ineffectual, lukewarm, and I know it's not a good message to hear, and it feels, sounds like I'm beating you down a little bit. It gets good. Grace comes in, but wait. You have to see the symptoms of the church. He says, be zealous. Be boiling over for me like a pot that can't keep the water in it. What are you jealous for? I'm going to argue this, and I'll say what you're jealous for is probably the thing that's been the dominating factor of your life. Look around you right now. Think about it. I won't apply it. You know, I won't get you to say it out loud now. But think, what is it that makes you burn with jealousy? And he says to this church, you're no longer jealous of me, for me. You no longer put me as your supreme passion, your heart's intent. And what you do is then you start to be jealous of everything else in your life. Let me give a silly example. Here's a stupid one. It's really silly, and I'm doing this so because I realize, like, if I'm saying you're not jealous of God and I sound like I'm beating you down, I'll give you a stupid story about me. Here you go. And you apply it your own way. It's really silly. This is not meant to be like some vast exposure of my heart this afternoon, okay? It's really dumb. What does it mean to be jealous for something and have a misguided jealousy? Here it is. Most of you know, and I've told this story, that when I was a young child, I had what you would call and define a rather large head and a rather small body. I've since sort of caught up in that regard, ratio-wise speaking. But when I was a child, it was rather freakish. I was going to show you a picture, but I thought that would just burn into your brain and you wouldn't think about anything else during the sermon. My head, at times, people wondered, my mom did, why I wouldn't topple over. She said, there's no way that your body can support that head. So naturally, if you have a large melon head and a small little body, you're not going to be that good at athletics, which I wasn't. Now, I loved playing soccer. I always have. I love the sport of soccer. I get obsessed about it. Don't talk to me when the World Cup comes around. It gets mania in my house. I'm up at all hours of the night watching every single game. I love it. I was passionate. But you know what? When I was a kid, I wasn't jealous for soccer. And you know why I knew that? Because I didn't just love the game for what it was. I didn't love the beauty of it. You know what I did? I'd go home every time after practice, and I'd skulk, and I'd cry sometimes, and I was brokenhearted. Why? Because my big head and little body couldn't keep up with everybody else on the field. I wasn't jealous for the game and the beauty of it. I was jealous because everybody else had nice bodies, and they could run, and they could jump, and they could do things I couldn't do. And I hated it. And I hated it. I told you it's a stupid story, and most of you may not deal with self-image issues as a child. Maybe you did, and maybe you know what that kind of feels like, but you hear, see the point? Look where my jealousy was pointed. My jealousy wasn't on the object of the game itself and the beauty of it. Now it is. I don't care that I have a big head, and I am rather still unathletic. But when I go play soccer, I don't care. Make fun of me all you want. My wife watches me play soccer sometimes, and she chuckles. She said, what are you doing out there? You're old, you're slow, you're fat. Get out. Now, she didn't say that. I feel that. That's okay. That's my self-image issues. We're struggling with it. But here's the point. I'm no longer jealous about what other people have. Why? Because all I wanted was to look like them and act like them and talk like them and be able to run like them and be cool like them. The wishes of a fifth grader. I wasn't jealous for the game. I was jealous of others because they had what I didn't have. And Jesus looks at his church in Laodicea and he says, you're no longer jealous for me. You no longer boil over for me. You're lukewarm. Their condition was so bad that, in essence, when Jesus says, I want to spit you out, that Greek is actually the word for to vomit. He says, I look at you and you make me want to vomit. You have everything. You dress well. You speak well. You work well. You've got it all. And you make me nauseous, he says. Pretty harsh stuff. One thing I want to say before we move on in terms of the symptoms, it was lukewarmness, but here, there's a part where we're likely to misunderstand it a little bit. Let me explain where he says, I wish you were either hot or cold. And if you're a Christian or you've been to church many, many years, you say, well, that sounds silly. Why would Jesus want me to be cold? Because we think of spiritual coldness as spiritual deadness. Not so much. Because you'd have to know something of the geography of Laodicea to know what he's talking about. And most commentators, there's a lot of ways commentators and pastors read that part. And some of them do say, well, he doesn't want you to be spiritually cold, blah, blah, blah. But no, he says, I wish you were either hot or cold, but you're lukewarm and you make me nauseous. What is he referring to here? Laodicea was bordered, had neighbored two cities. One was Hierapolis, and Hierapolis was famous for its hot spa waters. Ooh, isn't that nice? The waters outside, sort of like a Japanese onsen, where you could go outside in the hillside and soak in their soothing hot waters. And they had a fresh hot water source, so they were able to pipe it directly into the city. And it was hot, and it was soothing, and it was comforting, and it was warm. And people from miles around went to that city, Hierapolis, for those hot waters. Laodicea had another neighbor, Colossae. Colossae was known for its really cold, refreshing mineral-type water. And it was almost medicinal. People would travel for miles to go to Colossae to get this water. It was rich and it was cold and it was fresh and it was nice and it was soothing. Look what Jesus is saying. I wish, he says, you either were hot and soothing or cold and refreshing. But you're lukewarm. You're ineffective, church. You make me nauseous and therefore you probably make your neighbors nauseous. You probably make your coworkers nauseous. You're lukewarm, you're not boiling over, you're not zealous, you're not jealous for me, he says anymore. And he says, I wish you were either like the hot water in that town over there or the cold water in that other town. But see, Laodicea, they didn't have a water source. They had to pipe their water in from one of those two towns. And the excavators looked at the aqueduct system and they realized that by the time the water got from either one of those towns, which were many miles away, It would have been putrid and sickening to drink. So by the time when Laodicea hears this letter, they know exactly what Jesus is talking about, because the very water they drink is putrid and tepid and sickening and nauseating. And Jesus says, you're just like that. And Laodicea would have heard that and said, oh no, we know what that tastes like. I don't want to taste like that. Cold water is refreshing. Hot water is soothing. Lukewarm water just gets you sick and nasty. That's the symptom. Lukewarm. He says, you are lukewarm and I want to spit you out. You're not going to make a difference in the world. And he says, here's what's the problem. What's the problem? That's the symptom, but there's a sickness. There's something underneath. Here's Dr. Jesus again. He's giving you the symptom. He said, Laodicea, you are lukewarm. Why? What got them to be this case? Well, look. Let me pause for 1 second and tell you what it's not. And then what it is. The sickness for the church in Laodicea was not that they weren't fulfilling their obligations as a church. You notice he doesn't look at them and says, you're doing evil things. He doesn't look at them and say, oh my gosh, you're out there in the neighborhood that you shouldn't be in. You're with people you shouldn't be hanging around. You're doing all the wrong things. He doesn't talk about their deeds. He doesn't criticize their lack of works. He doesn't criticize their church attendance. He doesn't criticize the amount of time they read the Bible. And he doesn't criticize the amount of time they pray. No, 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 no. He looks inside at their true condition. And he says, you don't even know how poor and pitiful and naked and wretched you are on the inside. You're rotting. And the real sickness comes in verse 17 and 18. And he says this, for you say, I am rich. I've prospered. And I need nothing. Not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire so that you may be rich, and white garments so that you may clothe yourself, and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes so that you may see. Again, you got to go by context. I know that doesn't mean much to you now. White robes, I'll explain it. Money, gold and money doesn't really matter maybe to you. It's eye salve. You're like, who cares about eye medicine? Oh, but those who read this letter in Laodicea would have felt the sting of what he's saying. Here's why. We know Laodicea, historically speaking, was known mainly for three main things. Mainly, they were famous. One, they were a financial center. They were wealthy. So much so that there was an earthquake in 60 AD, destroyed the town. And if you were a town that got destroyed by an earthquake, which happened quite often at the time, you'd have to plead to Rome to help rebuild you, because that's where all the money was. Laodicea built themselves back up. No help from Rome. They had enough money to do it. It was very unique at this time. They were very wealthy. They were a center for banking. They were a financial center. So to be called poor, that's an insult. For secondly, they were a textile center. Here's a little trivia. They had sheep. They had sheep, and they were black. Or they were known to be dark colored, and they made this really, really, really cool black shiny wool. And it was very unique. I mean, other cities had it, but this one, Laodicea knew how to make it. And their clothes were shiny, which that didn't really happen much that back in the day. And they glistened with this black wool. They were dressed very well. Jesus says, you're naked. That's an insult. Lastly, as I said before, they were a medical center. They were known all around for making this one particular eye medicine. And everybody traveled there. If you had eye problems, you'd go and you'd rub it on your eyes and you'd hope that it would heal it. And most often it did. And Jesus looks at them and says, you're blind. That's an insult. This is why it's so important. This is why it's almost ironic. When Jesus in verse 17 to 18 says, you say you need nothing, but you're poor. You have all the money you need, but you're poor. You say you need nothing, and you dress really well, but you're naked and wretched. You say you need nothing, but you're sick, even though you have the hospitals all around you in your town. What he's doing is he's doing this. The very things that they were most proud of are the very things that are making them numb and deadening them. And they can't even see it. And if you were a person in Laodicea at this time and you read that letter, you would be highly offended. How dare Jesus say this about me? I have money. I have nice clothes. And I am feeling great today. And he says, nope. You got it all wrong. It would have been incredibly offensive to you. And I'm pushing this out to say this. I don't know what a modern day example is. And I don't want to know what I can say to you to offend you today. And I don't really want to offend you. Let me give another silly example. Listen, go to the gym. As some of you do. Go to the gym. Go up to a guy and, a guy who's got a lot of muscles. And he's flexing in front of the mirror, as many guys with muscles are wont to do. That's fine. And they're flexing. I dare you to go up to him and go, you are a puny, skinny, worthless peon. If you mustered up enough strength. Now, if you said that to the person, don't say it, by the way. That's just it's rhetorical. Don't say it. Pastor didn't tell you to go insult people at the gym. But if you said it to them, listen, either the person looks at you and says, you're a fool, get out of here. Or they just laugh at you and say, you're an idiot and you're insane. But they couldn't just dismiss you. Because the very thing that they were most proud of at the moment was the very thing that you were coming in to criticize. And this is exactly what Jesus does. He says, church, the things that you hold up as your pride and your joy are most likely the very things that are numbing you, that are making you lukewarm, nauseous, ineffective, wanting to be spit out. What is he saying? He says they're spiritually naked. They're sinners, not in need of a solution, but in need of grace and a savior. They're spiritually poor. They're unable to do it themselves. That's why he says, come to me, buy from me. You can't do it on your own. The city of Laodicea had done it on their own, rebuilt themselves. He says, you're spiritually naked, you're sinners in need of grace. You're spiritually poor, you're unable to do it yourself. And you are spiritually blind, you're unable to see what you really look like in the mirror. It's pretty salty stuff. It's pretty harsh. But Jesus gives them an out. He gives them the medicine that they need and that you need and that I need, that the church needs. Here it is. First of all, do you notice what's interesting? He says that they have to come to him to buy it. What is another way to say it is, he would look at the church and say, you are completely reliant on me to fix you. You need grace. Hold on. These are Christians after all. They would have known that. This wasn't somebody who was on the outskirts and didn't believe, and God says, you need grace and you need to come to me and help. These are already believing Christians, professing Christians. They go to church every week. And God says, you can't do it on your own. You're blind. You're self-sufficient. You're prospering. And it's at this time that the church is least transformed by the grace and the beauty of the cross. Do you see this? They're no longer zealous. They're no longer jealous. They're no longer boiling over. Because they have everything they need. So the cross doesn't look as beautiful to them. And they became ineffective. Let me give a story here. William Booth, he's the founder, many of you probably know, of the Salvation Army. Despite what your beliefs are about the Salvation Army, they have been one of the greatest sources of humanitarian aid throughout history now. And William Booth is a tried and true Christian. And he writes about, he founded the Salvation Army way back in the day. He was a Methodist preacher. Founds the Salvation Army, and he writes, well, after many years, he writes that there was a time in which he took his own pulse. He took his own spiritual check. And he said, he write about this passage in Laodicea, and he realized when he had become spiritually lukewarm, and it was at a rather unique moment. He was at a lecture that was given by a well-known atheist at the time. And he remembers, I don't remember in the story if the atheist said it directly to him, but rather or not, it doesn't matter if he said it directly because William Booth felt like he was saying it directly to them. The atheist was going through this whole long diatribe about how he didn't believe in God and how God couldn't exist and so on and so forth and so on and so forth. And he ended by saying this, and it struck William Booth forever after that. And he says, now I know I've just been lukewarm. Now keep in mind, this is William Booth, found the Salvation Army. He's checked all the boxes. Oh, and he was a minister. That's good too, right? Wrong. He says, I've had everything. And here's what the guy ended. He ended on this way to say this. He closed by saying, if I believed, the atheist, if I believed what you Christians say you believe about a coming judgment and that impenitent rejectors of Christ will all be lost, I would crawl on my bare knees on crushed glass all over London, warning men night and day to repent and to turn to Christ, who is their only place of refuge. This is a non-believer. And he ended, and William Booth was convicted because he looked at everybody and he says, if I were you, if I believed a third of what you Christians say you believe, I'd crawl around London on my knees on crushed glass just to tell everybody about it. That's zealous. That's boiling over. That's not lukewarm. That's hot or cold. It's not nauseous. So what's the medicine? What do you got to do? Well, good thing is you don't really have to do anything. Jesus did it all for you. Let me explain. What's the cure? Jesus says it at the end of the passage. He looks at the church in Laodicea and he says, you've got to come to me to buy some things, to get some things. In order for you as a church not to be lukewarm, I want you to be hot and soothing or cold and refreshing to the world around you, to your coworkers, to everybody. I want you to put your love so intently on me, Jesus would say, that you are not jealous of anything else in the world. You're jealous for me. And he says, you have to come and get it from me as a way to say, first and foremost, you have to rely on me. You can't do it on your own. But then in verse 19, he offers three things. And these are a little harsh to hear. I'm not going to unpack them fully because we just don't have the time. But he offers three things. And he says, listen, almost in a way, you want to get out of being lukewarm as a Christian? Good. He says, then you're going to have to do and have these three things happen to you. He talks about suffering and repentance and love and fellowship. First, suffering. He says he'll discipline or he'll chasten in the old King James Version. And it sounds harsh, but he's saying this. Most often, when you go through discipline and hard times and harshness in your life and tests and trials, that's when you get hot or that's when you get cold. It's almost impossible to go through suffering in the life of a Christian and remain lukewarm. Now, on the other hand, it's almost impossible to avoid suffering as a Christian and stay and get out of your lukewarm condition. He says there will be chastening, there will be disciplining first. And I know that's harsh to hear, but it gets better. He says there's going to be chastening and suffering. There's going to be also repentance. He says, repent, turn around. You're going to have to change your life, change the center of the object of the thing that you post about. What are you jealous of? What eats at you at night? What wakes you up in the morning? That's the center of your life. That's the throne. That's your functional God, Jesus would argue. Lastly, though, he says love and fellowship. He says this. Remember this famous passage? He says, I'm at the door. I'm knocking. And if you open it, I'll come in and I'll eat with you. And there's a famous painting that you might remember of Jesus standing on the outside of a door. The door doesn't have a knob on it. The knobs on the inside is a way to say this, and many pastors say, well, believers have to open the door and let Jesus come in. Yeah, yes, true, but look at what's going on here. Dinner, to eat with somebody at this time. That was everything. This is the only God who says, I look at you, and I want to vomit you out. You make me vomit, but I want to come and eat with you. I want to sit with you. In the ultimate form of intimacy and fellowship, at this time, to invite somebody to come to dinner was infinitely more meaningful and impactful than it is even today. And he says, if you just open the door, I'll come in. You make me vomit, but I love you still. And if you've been married, sometimes you probably feel that about your spouse every once in a while. You make me vomit, but I love you. You make me sick, but I can't leave you. And Jesus is the same thing. He's knocking. Now, how do you get it? But in Soul Grace, every week we used to recite the Apostles' Creed. And there's a part that says, you know, Jesus died and he rose again and he sits at the right hand of God. Look at this passage. Jesus says to the church in Laodicea, if you come to me by grace and grace alone, you get to sit on the throne. If you make me the jealous center of your heart, Jesus would say, if you see my love poured out for you, and if that's the center thing, if that makes you boil, then you get to sit at the throne. Why? Because he lost the throne. He conquered, he says in this letter to the church. He says, I conquered, therefore you've conquered. Be jealous of nothing else in your life. Put nothing at the center, otherwise you'll become lukewarm. You'll crave that thing. You'll say, I need nothing. I have a good job. I have a good family. I have a good money. And that's precisely the point at when the church becomes so lukewarm that it's nauseating. And Jesus says, if you only come to me. And he offers them three things as I close. He says, you get white robes, you get gold, and you get salve for your eyes. And if you look, this is the exact opposite of what Jesus gets when he's killed. Why do you get white robes? Remember a couple weeks ago I said that white robes were the symbol of victory. Roman emperors would wear them when they went back into the town after a big victory. And Jesus says, you get victory. Why? I got stripped naked for you and put on that cross. You think you're dressed well. See how naked you are and see how much you rely on me. You get robes. Victory. Life. Why? I was stripped, he says, naked on the cross. You get gold. Why? Because he died on the cross, penniless, friendless, abandoned by his own father. For you. What kind of gold do you want now on earth? You got it there because he was poor. Lastly, you get salve for your eyes so that you can see right. How? Because in the book of Luke, it was Jesus who got the things put on his head where he was blindfolded and he was beaten and he was pummeled and he was beaten into his face. And they looked at him and they laughed and they said, okay, now tell us who struck you. He was blinded so that you can see. You need to see him stripped for you. You need to see him dying penniless and friendless for you. And you need to see him with that bag over his head getting pummeled and beaten to death and people mocking him and laughing at him so that you will never, ever have to do that. Jesus says, simply come to me. Buy it from me. I lost it for you. Jesus wasn't just a friend willing to suffer for what he believed. Any religious leader can do that. Jesus was a God king who did suffer because he believed in you and loved you. That's what's at the center. That's the gospel. White robes, because he was naked. Gold, because he was poor. Sight, because he was struck blind and dead. Let that be the thing that you, that we as a church, get jealous for. Go in prayer now. Meditate on that. Think about what it means to be hot or cold in light of the gospel.